From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a look back at some of the historic events of 2016 with Professor Tony Montero. Professor Montero, a pleasure. We get to wrap up the year now.
Yes, very, very good, man. I look forward to this, man. It's been a hell of a year.
It has. The election of Donald Trump and the passing of Fidel Castro, among other things, but those two very important events.
Yeah, and in fact, I think they are two events that define not only the year, but the era that we're living in, our time. You know, the election of Donald Trump says a lot about where the advanced capitalist countries are, the Euro-American world is at this time in history. It seems that more than anything else, a real crisis of leadership, of rule, of the rule of the 1% and the neoliberal super managers over society is being challenged in a fundamental sense. It might collapse. It seems that the probabilities are quite high that the old form of rule is collapsing. The new is not yet emerging. But the West is in a period of great instability. The stock market in the United States has reached a historic landmark, 20,000 points, while the economy is in stagnation and most of the jobs created over the last year, in fact, 95% of the jobs created over the last 10 years have not been permanent jobs. They have been kind of what they call contract labor, where there is no guarantee that you'll have the job the next week or the next month or even the next year. So great inequality and great instability in the Euro-American world, the major centers of global capitalism. On the other side, the passing of Fidel Castro showed that the leadership and people of Cuba are united, that there is no crisis of leadership, that Fidel's passing was handled with dignity and his life was honored by billions of people from all over the world. Just the opposite of what is going on in the main capitalist countries. So I think these two events symbolize the times that we live in and probably tell us a great deal about what things will look like going forward.
So let's take a broad look in each case. First, in Europe, certainly the Anglo-American world, but also the West, so-called, including Europe, that crisis that Trump's election represents. Also, you had the Brexit vote and votes across Europe from Italy to Bulgaria to the half a dozen other countries where there's a shift. Also, Turkey seems to be tilting towards Russia. Certainly the Philippines is tilting towards China. So you have big changes in that sphere. On the other hand, the so-called conservative resurgence, or variety of names that they applied to the election of Macri in Argentina and the removal of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, seems to have fizzled out, and there's great instability and an awful lot of working class activity there. So let's start with with Trump here in the U.S. and relations with other Western countries and Japan and Korea?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think starting here with Trump is a good place to start because, you know, this is the major economic and military center of world capitalism. I think that we're now, as the data comes in, we're seeing that, in fact, the election of Trump was actually a vote against the existing neoliberal order. You know, because the polling and survey data that we're now getting shows that it was not a white lash. This was not a vote against what the first black president symbolized. Unless we're saying that what the first black president symbolized was the rule of this 1%, this neoliberal managerial elite. If that's what he represented, then you could say it's a vote against the first black president. But it would seem that it was not a vote against him because he is black. It's a vote against him because of the class forces that he represents. You know, the data comes out that among women who support Planned Parenthood, 48% of them voted for Trump, 47% for Clinton. There's more data coming out about the Trump voters. Percentages of them did not support his views on a number of issues, but did support him on the questions of jobs, an end to the type of trade arrangements like NAFTA and TPP, and frankly supported him in his position against intervention, regime change, and nation building, which suggests that the America First slogan for, I would say, the majority of Trump voters meant a pullback from war and a pullback from the neoliberal global order, which in essence means a pullback from the American empire as the hegemonic force in the world. Saying in essence, the American people can no longer afford to pay for this kind of nonsense. This is huge. And if it spreads to Europe, as it is predicted that it will, and we already saw it in Italy in the last few weeks, but if it spreads to France, as it probably will, and Le Pen saying she will withdraw from the European Union and NATO if president of France, and then to Germany, it would seem that the game is up, that a whole new order is being born. And you are right. It seems now that Turkey is breaking with NATO and with the West in significant ways. Erdogan saying that he wants to join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, yeah, which is led by Russia and China.
Yep.
His looking east rather than west. Duterte in the Philippines, looking to China and not towards the United States, and breaking military ties and the military occupation of the Philippines. If that goes down in the Philippines, who is to say that the same processes will not take place in South Korea and in other countries? As you know, with the collapse of the proposal for TPP, China has now proposed a new regional trading pact, a new free market in the Asia-Pacific region, which excludes the United States, in the same way that the TPP was designed to exclude China.
Yeah.
So we're on the cusp of a new crisis in the imperialist world, and certainly in the United States, and I would say new opportunities for struggle.
You know, and it's interesting how, as this crisis has unfolded, the response of the powers that be sitting on top of this hegemonic construct or wannabe hegemonic construct, the voices have gotten more shrill, and their actions almost flat-footed, like they're off guard. They keep repeating the same strategy. For example, the media is still running the political campaign for the presidency that they ran before Trump was elected. They're still running that. You've got they try to double down. I mean, in Japan, you have the unprecedented move of Abe coming to Pearl Harbor at a time that the people are in the streets in Okinawa about, getting the U.S. military out of there after 71 years of occupation. Across the board, you're seeing an attempt, certainly across Latin America, we saw it over the last few years, where they got particularly aggressive and trying to kick Venezuela out of Mercosur and, these other regional groupings, the coup in Brazil, all of this. And yet, all it seems to do is mobilize the forces in opposition to the hegemon, both in Europe and Asia on the one hand, and also in Latin America.
I would agree with you. Contrary to the notion that we're on the verge of a new right-wing takeover, I would suggest that we're on the verge, possibly, of its opposite. Now, clearly, you take the United States, there are bitter struggles going on within the ruling class. I mean, just over the question of Trump's putting together an administration, a government, which, again, I would suggest will not be able to govern. I think even his administration is filled with profound contradictions, not to mention contradictions between his administration and those that were ousted by his election. But I think, again, the largest contradictions, the largest struggles are over foreign policy and whether or not the U.S. empire will be able to withstand the forces of anti-Americanism, of anti-American empire, anti-American imperialism that are consolidating and growing in strength around the world. That's what their concern is. And that is why the first task for the neocons, for those who were ousted, is to bring Putin down in Russia, whatever that takes. And let's not be unclear about this. It is not just to contain Russia. It is to bring the government of Russia down. And that means what they call a color revolution. And of course, they want to put pressure, economic pressure, through sanctions and military pressure, through bringing NATO to the borders of Russia. They thought that they could drag Russia into a prolonged struggle in Syria. That ended more or less with the liberation of East Aleppo. But this targeting of Russia is to challenge now what they consider the major obstacle to the consolidation of American and Western imperialist domination of the world economy and of the world's people. And of course, I mean, as we have talked about this so often, Don, Trump, at least in his statements, and it now seems in his actions by who he has appointed as Secretary of State, wants a rapprochement, a detente with Russia, and a pullback of NATO from the borders of Russia. I think we're in a hell of a time.
Yeah, assuming we get to January 20th without, the start of war with Russia, I've heard the theory floated out that what is going to happen with Trump is going to be an emphasis of change in emphasis of belligerence towards Russia rather towards China. And the situation that they face right now, you had the rise of the BRICS happen over the course of the Obama administration, and the assertion of some independence of Russia and China at the United Nations, beginning with the first veto of Syria resolution in 2011 and some successive vetoes there. But really, it was the imposition of sanctions on Russia at the same time that they began belligerence against China in the South China Sea that led to what the current situation that they both term as a strategic partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And what Russia means within that strategic partnership is a nuclear umbrella protecting itself in China, including the installation of air defenses, the S-400s in China. It also means the development of Russia without Western capital, using Chinese capital to build a transcontinental railroad connecting Beijing to Moscow and beyond. And, of course, the development of all of the cities along that route and of the country itself. And when you look at such a vast territory with a population of only 150 million, more or less, and then 1.6 billion people, or 10 times as many people, packed into a much smaller area immediately adjacent, you can see the future looking at a map. It seems that some people think Trump's strategy is going to be to try to invoke Nixon and split China and Russia apart, with friendship towards Russia and maybe even concessions in Europe, allowing Russia to become more integrated into the European economy on the one hand and belligerence towards China on the other. Do you see that as American policy under Trump?
I don't. For some people, it's wishful thinking. I think that what Trump has said, and I take him at his word, is that in essence, he's talking about a pullback. You see, if he wanted that type of policy towards China, it seems to me that he would not have opposed TPP, because TPP was the economic financial arm of the pivot to Asia, right, which also meant the redeployment of the American Navy in Asia and the role of the Philippines, of course. With the Philippines government moving towards China in the ways that they have, suggest that the American position, especially under Obama, collapsed, and that Trump, by opposing TPP, cannot regain that initiative. I mean, I think for that initiative to work, you need both the Philippines, Vietnam, Japan, in particular. I just don't see it. Now, Trump does not have, as it seems to me, a policy going forward in Asia. What he has said is that he wants to withdraw from the U.S. being the one that upholds and finances the nuclear and so-called defense umbrella in Asia.
Right.
He wants to back off of that, and he's made statements about negotiating a reunification of the Korean Peninsula. But we have to see going forward. I think that the target of American imperialist military forces is and will remain up until maybe January 20th, Russia. And everything will be done to undermine any kind of rapprochement with Russia. That's the obsession. That's the concern and such.
Let's turn to Latin America. You've had, you had the rise of a block of states that prized and exercised their sovereignty and right of self-determination. that installed, if not socialist economies, certainly mixed economies across the board, a rejection of right-wing dictatorships, a rejection of U.S. interference, and a huge pushback from the United States that really began in earnest under the Obama administration.
Absolutely.
Starting perhaps with the coup against the Mel Zelaya in Honduras, and the attempted coup by Bush, of course, has to be noted in 2002 in Venezuela, but after that, they more or less left Venezuela alone until the Obama administration, and then that has been a major target. The attempts by the parties in Colombia to reach a peace agreement brokered in Havana were also opposed by the U.S., and again, we've had the election of Macri, which had U.S. influence certainly involved, and the removal of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil. But you have a heightened, almost every day, you see masses of people on the streets in Brazil, Argentina, and elsewhere in the region against the right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and a lot of the political chaos in Latin America has to do with the economic crisis, of course, beginning with Venezuela and the price of oil plummeting. I don't think that the right will be able to win in this new battle. I think both in Argentina and Brazil, and certainly in Venezuela, the left will ultimately win these battles. Now, the question becomes, in all of these countries, the political relationships within the military. But I suspect that the forces of the left and of the masses, including the trade unions and women's organizations and the young people, are pro-socialism, and they are not in any way interested in going back to forms of capitalist dependency on the United States. So I think the socialist forces have the support generally of the broad masses of people. The question is the ideological and propaganda war that the right is able to conduct, supported by the United States and supported by social media and corporate media in the various countries, but they're able to mount a propaganda and ideological attack upon the governments, which are unable to do everything they wish to do because of the economic crisis. And as a result, they're able to destabilize momentarily these left governments. But I think in the medium term that that the left is going to win. And I think it's going to come out of this stronger. I think the Venezuelan left, was kind of disoriented with the death of Hugo Chavez. I think that the Venezuelan left will come out of this much stronger than what they were when they went into it.
And looking at the changing conditions in Europe and Asia, on the one hand, for the United States, and the apparent change of policy that we're looking at in terms of withdrawing military protection, basically, or you might look at it instead as military occupation of Europe up to Russia's border and of Japan, South Korea, other places in Asia. With China engaging more and more in business with the countries of Central and South America and the Caribbean, the construction of the canal and all of these things that are likely to happen over the Trump administration. Is it possible that this new world order could be more collaborative, where the U.S. is in Asia doing business not because it's at gunpoint and there to loot, but rather because they're mutually beneficial trade arrangements that are staked out, and likewise that the U.S. may remain the guarantor, the ultimate guarantor of Latin America against European or Asian power, but would suffer gladly profitable engagement with China and Europe?
Well, that's the rational thing, and that's the optimal thing under conditions of multiple centers of world power and multiple social and economic systems, that there would be détente and rapprochement rather than attempts at hegemony and overthrow and chaos. I mean, you would hope for that. I think we, in this regard, have to start with the Middle Eastern countries. And that is where, you know, all of the wars have taken place over the last 25 years. I mean, beginning with Iraq. Maybe you could go back to the Iraq-Iran war in the early 1980s. But in terms of the complete destabilization of a region, the Middle East is the tinderbox, the place where something serious could kick off. So I think the vote in the UN Security Council, although more symbolic than anything else, where the Security Council again condemned Israeli occupation of the West Bank. Now, they condemn it, but they don't do anything to undermine it, which is the problem. Never sanctions against Israel for violating UN Security Council resolutions.
Right.
But nonetheless, I think the complete liberation of Syria, which at the same time would suggest the liberation of Iraq from ISIL and al-Nusra forces, but Iraq will not yet be liberated from American military forces, and that's huge. But to liberate Syria is a blow to Israel, because Syria is a major cornerstone of what they call the arc of resistance, that is, resistance to Israeli militarism. I just think that we have to keep our eyes on the Middle East, because that's where war could break out. And I think we've moved a good distance from where we were at the beginning of 2016, and that is in a positive way in the Middle East. But obviously, the world is interconnected, and what affects one region of the world affects the world generally. And so we cannot, by focusing on the Middle East or focusing on the Ukraine because of U.S. belligerency and so on, we have to keep our eye on what the Chinese are doing in Asia, especially the building, as you say, of all of these railways and the connecting of peoples in this great Eurasian trading zone, which is larger than the Pacific, and would bring Europe into the economic zone of Asia rather than the Atlantic, transatlantic alliance. I mean, I just, you know, to me, this is a spectacular moment where many of the crises and problems that have beset humanity can be resolved, including global warming. We can stabilize the climate and begin to reverse the effects of global warming. But first and foremost, we have to relieve the world of the burden of American hegemony and militarism. That is the principal task at this time. And if I could just say one other thing, the American left, if it is to be worth anything, has to become a part of this historical process, which is breaking down and weakening American hegemony and giving space for the rise of a whole new world order predicated upon the ideas of peace and the common prosperity of humanity.
Professor Montero, thank you very much. Happy New Year to you, sir.
Thank you, and the same to you, Don.
Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.